Good morning, everybody. My name is Doris Bridges. I'm a very grateful recovering member of a worldwide fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen. When I first got here yesterday, as we were driving in, and I had been on the website to look, I thought, what a peaceful, wonderful weekend coming up. And my parents had a little place at a lake, and I would carry girls down there that I sponsored, and one of my very good friends would take some girls she sponsored, and we would have a little spiritual retreat weekend. And this is what it reminds me of. And whenever I would go down there, even for just a weekend of any kind, it was like my body just slowed down. Get out of the hustle and bustle of life and enjoy God's work. And that's what it felt when I pulled in here. And the first person I ran into was there were a bunch of guys sitting in the lobby, and I asked where registration was, and John said, it's right over there. He said, but there's nobody there now. And I said, okay. He walks around, and he said, now there is. And I thought, oh, wonderful. This is great. I love it, you know. I love just that laid-back, you know, thing. But anyway, oh, gosh. This is a gorgeous setting. It really is. I'm so excited about being here. And y'all, it's like homecoming for me here, and I've never been to this place. But there's some people here who are very special to me. And some of them my world is just getting smaller by the minute by being here. Milton and Joanne and my first husband and I have traveled a lot together in caravaned. And he says, we'll never caravan again. He said, nobody wants to use the bathroom at the same time. Nobody wants to eat at the same time. He said, you just can't get everybody together. And I think, well, that's because there's lots of kids and women, you know. And then Juanita was one of the first people that I ever heard speak. I've heard her numerous times, and she had such an impact on my life. Those early speakers that you hear, oftentimes you don't forget them. You just don't forget them. And she and Bob, I've heard both of them several times, and it's just a joy to be able to be here. And I know y'all have missed a couple of years here, but I'm so grateful that God put you here for me to see you again. And let's see, Walt, had lunch breakfast with him this morning, and I just found out that my mother's next door neighbor, who I grew up with, who is older than me, and she would take me to places that I could not go at my age, but she was friends of the people who owned it. And it's a club in West Memphis, several of them. And he, I guess, was a bouncer because he threw Joanne out. And I'm thinking, just hilarious. But she's a typical Al-Anon. She found her way right back in, manipulated the guy that owned it that she knew. And he came back in and she's back at the table where he just kicked her out from. So you never know who you'll see here. And there's a car out back by the motel that has an Arkansas tag on it. Oh, it's yours? Do you live in Arkansas? It says... Oh, that must be his alias. Is that a Ford 500? Is that a Ford 500? Okay. Anyway, it's red. It's red, and it reminded me of a Ford 500 that I had that was red not long ago. But anyway, yeah, it's just amazing. I thought, there's somebody here from Arkansas. I wonder if I know them. I didn't think I did when he praised his hand. It was his, and then I thought, that's the guy. That's I did know him. Oh, me. And he knows lots of my friends, I think. Anyway, I'm not here to tell y'all what of all these people that and I'm so grateful to be able to meet some new people. I love that, you know. Tony, I met him yesterday. He came in. He had two bags of candy, two boxes of candy. And Floyd said, what's his name? I said, I can't remember. I asked him what's his name, and then he said, I don't know. And I said, to be perfectly honest with you, I did not catch his name because I was too busy looking at those two boxes of candy. But, yeah. He had peanut butter in one and chocolate in the other, and I said, I thought, man, he's really done good. And I was complimenting him. He said, no, my wife did that, so thank you, because I went straight there last night and got me some. Anyway, I'm going to go back and tell you just a little bit about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that I'm to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I'm going to try to do that in a short and concise way. It's hard to put that many years into an hour or 45 minutes, whatever. I have one sibling. He's 5 years older than I am. Neither of my parents were drinkers. The only person I knew in my life that drank was a step-grandfather, and he worked on the riverboat, and they would dock in Memphis, and when he would come, I was a very small child, and he impressed me because he gave me money. It wasn't a lot of money. It was just change. There was a little grocery store at the corner of our street, and he would give me money, and he was always drinking. Now, my parents were not as excited to see him as I was every time he came. But anyway, I lost track of him many years down the road, and I think he no longer is living. I'm sure I don't know how he could possibly be living now, but would have loved to have seen him, you know, as I got older. I did not know until I came in here that my mother is probably the daughter of an alcoholic father. We didn't talk about things like that as I was growing up as a child, but all I know was that her daddy died at the age of 40 with cirrhosis of the liver. And so I began to ask her some things about that, and so that's the side of my mother. And my mother is a great caretaker. She can't today. Someone has to take care of her. But growing up, she was a wonderful caretaker. She never worked outside the home. She always cooked 3 meals a day. She was the PTA room mother. She was always there every day when I got home from school. She's just always been there. And I hate that my children had to have a working mother. I wish I could have been there like she was for me. My daddy was a mechanic by trade. We were not of great financial means by any means, but my daddy often caught crickets and sold them for a penny a piece just to make ends meet on the side. He drove a wrecker 24/7 for the shop where he worked as well. But we had our wants, our needs met, you know, not our wants, but our needs all met. Food, clothing, and shelter. We never did without any of those things. My brother today is a white collar worker. He's a mama's boy. On the other hand, I was a tomboy. Wherever my daddy was, that's where I wanted to be. If it was in the woods, that's where I wanted to be. If it was out there in the shop working on a lawnmower, that's where I wanted to be. And I can change the oil in a car. I choose not to do that today and haven't for a long time, especially if you can find somebody to do it for you, and there's all kinds of places that do that today. But I had the same things growing up that most of you have. Like I said, you know, I was a cheerleader and I did some things like that, and even then my parents couldn't afford for me to do that. And I don't know how any parent affords for a child to do that today. It's not anything like it was when I was a cheerleader. You know, you need a skirt and a sweater and a pair of tennis shoes. But today it's entirely different than that. But my brother worked at the theater, and he opted to give me the money to buy that, my uniform. And I won't ever forget that, because I'm surprised he did it, because I was a pain in his side all the time. He smoked, and when he was on up, and, you know, teenager, and I would want to go with him and his girlfriend, and he'd say, I can't go, and I'd tell him, if he don't let me go, I'm going to tell Mom, Dad, you're smoking, you know, all those things, you know. And we'd get in an argument, and my mother would say, you go to that room, and you go to that room, and you're not going to come out until you kiss and make up, and my brother's, and that was tickling me to death. I thought, he's going to have to kiss me. And he'd say, I'll stay here till I die. So just normal childhood. Like I said, I never saw either of my parents drink to excess. I'm not even sure I ever saw my daddy drink. If I did, I don't remember it. And my mother was very skinny, and I did see her drink beer one a day for a while to try to gain weight. That's what they told you to do years ago. And it will put the weight on you. It's full of calories, that's for sure. But anyway, I want to kind of fast forward a little bit. When I was a senior in high school, my year between my junior and senior year, I met a gentleman, and he was a 17-year-old boy. He lived 50 miles from where I lived, and his brother lived in West Memphis, and he would come for the summer and work at the service station where his brother worked. This is my introduction to my first husband, who is the person who qualifies me to be here, in my opinion, and I am forever grateful that he has the disease of alcoholism. I know that sounds terrible to hear someone say that, but had he not been, I would not probably be here today. Al-Anon has saved my life, and he's the person who allowed me to be here. And he and I are good friends today, I will tell you that, and that's a great thing, and that's because of the fellowship of Al-Anon and AA. That's what that's all about. It's a fringe benefit that we get just because we are trying to work the principles of the program, and they work if you work it. Anyway, I met him, and he dropped out of school after his junior year of college, and I mean of school, and I graduated that year, and we immediately got married and proceeded to start a family. I have two daughters. One of them is, I have to stop and think, 51. And my youngest daughter is 47. So y'all won't have to, you know, kind of get some idea of how old I really am. Anyway, sometimes it's older than others, I think. I don't know. But he and I, like I said, started a family, and we partied a lot. I love to dance. I mean, that's just one of my passions. I love to do that. I care nothing about drinking. And if I'm going to do it at all, it's going to be Kool-Aid, some kind of something that looks like Kool-Aid or pink or pretty or, you know, and I could care less whether it has any alcohol in it or not. You know, virgins are fine with me, you know. But I just never did. It just never did do anything for me. And I certainly am not. I've tried beer. I've tried everything else, too, I think. And I work the job I have. Used to have wine and cheese parties at places that I went. And I've tried all that, too. And I still haven't found anything I really care anything about, you know. So anyway, it's just not just for the grace of God. And when I say that, I'm not saying that I have grace and you don't. I'm just saying that is one of those things that just doesn't appeal to me. I care nothing about it. I was always the designated driver. I've never, ever been drunk. I've never drank enough to feel whatever you feel. You know, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that men and women drink essentially for the effects produced by alcohol. It does not say alcoholics. Men and women. So in other words, any of us who drink apparently are drinking, you know, for that feel that you're supposed to get. And I'm sure we'll all get it if you drink enough. But that's, you know, you'll see, I have the first 164 pages of the Big Book right here. I give this to all the girls I sponsor in the fellowship because I think it's a wonderful tool. I think it's just as important. You can see my readers, the dog's chewed it up. It's coming apart. It's falling apart inside. That's from use. That's from use. I love these books, and I love this program. But listen, I got married, and like I said, he's been sober since, I'm going to tell y'all, I came in the program in November the 16th, 1973. So 42 years ago, just last week, it was 42 years. And I don't tell you that to impress you, because I can tell you that there are times when I go into a meeting when I'm the sickest one in there that day. You know, there are days in my life today when I need it just as bad as the day I walk through the door. I don't have a perfect life. None of us ever will, you know. But just one day at a time is how I survived today. But he and I started this little family, and he was a mechanic. My daddy was a mechanic. We lived next door to my parents. And my mother kept this older daughter of ours when she was born a lot during the day. She'd rather be over there with them than she had with us, you know, just because she got her way. She was the first grandchild. She got anything she wanted, you know, from them. That was, you know, what they could do. But anyway, she loved being there. When she was about 18 months old, we moved away from there and brought that second daughter home. We had a second daughter after we moved, and it was just like 2 miles from where my parents live. So I only have the two daughters that belong to me. That's all I have. But I want to tell you that as we partied a little bit longer, you know, we tried don't drink before you go, you know, eat a big meal, eat a steak that we couldn't afford so you won't get drunk. That's what they would say, eat a big meal and it won't affect you so much. We'd buy a half pint or whatever that little bottle is so you won't drink very much. But yet I didn't know how much he was really drinking. I knew that he drank some when he was growing up in school, but he couldn't afford it because his parents were sharecroppers and they didn't have any money. And I remember when we got married, they canceled his burial insurance because it saved him 50 cents a month. That's how poor they were. I'd never lived like that. I'd lived in the city. I'm not a country girl. And when he and I met, his parents lived 5 miles out in the country on a gravel road. And they had quilts stuck in the windows and things like that. So that was all foreign to me. I worked at the theater at home and when I was a junior and senior in school, and I bought his school clothes. So I was a great enabler even then. Great enabler. But anyway, our life moved on and we kept partying and drinking just got worse, like it does. It's an illness. And it's a progressive illness. And it's a family illness. And everybody's affected. And I brought my children right into the middle of this, and they played games with me against their daddy. We've had bottles we've dumped in the living room floor because I have found them, you know, brought them there, and we'd have a family meeting so he could see how much he was drinking. I had a calendar, and I would mark on the calendar when he was drinking. You know, I did all kinds of things like that that were horrible today. I look back, and I know it was a terrible thing, and no matter how small your children are, I'm telling you, you do not get away with that without them knowing it. The smallest child at the age of 2, I'm sure, I've seen 2-year-olds that behaved in really strange ways because of a parent's drinking or problems in a family. Our oldest daughter, I had to take when she was in kindergarten because she was struggling in school. And come to find out, she said she knows way entirely too much for a child her age. I didn't keep anything from them. I didn't try to hide anything. And I didn't keep anything from our neighbors. I mean, I would tell you how sorry he was in a heartbeat. I didn't have any problem telling you. I mean, all of our neighbors knew all that. They knew he drank. Some of them drank with him, you know. But I didn't have a problem with that. I talked a lot, and I talked a lot today. My mouth is getting dry. But anyway, like alcoholism does, it progresses. And it progressed very quickly for us. And I'm going to share some things that went on before I get into my Al-Anon recovery. And I think that's the most important part. I want to let you know how I qualify for this program. And I don't want to tell his story, I want to tell mine. My parents have oftentimes bought groceries for us because we could not afford to do that. I went to work when our children were small. And I went to work in 1970. And I did that because we couldn't pay our bills. He was drinking up everything that he made, basically. And, you know, I would scrounge money back and buy him clothes for him to go to work in. And if they were pretty decent, he was putting them in the trunk. And when he'd get off from work, he'd change clothes and go out. And I made sure the kids went to the dentist and all that, but I let my own self go. I didn't care. You know, I didn't take care of me. And today that's a different story. I try to take care of me. I know that I'm pretty high up there because if I don't take care of me, I certainly can't take care of anybody else. Thank you very much for that. I think there's a bottle of water down here, but thank you very much. I do not want to spill this. There is a bottle. Anyway, I knew there was. I've forgotten it. I have left him out in the backyard in a lawn swing for it to rain on him deliberately, but that's where he passed out, and he got left there. I wasn't bringing him in. I have had... I'm really dating myself when I tell you about the wall phone, that the cords, you could see them coming down the wall. They weren't hidden like they are today. If you have a wall phone. Does anybody have a wall phone anymore? Hi, Gail, I can believe that. I can tell you. I have one still that you put your finger in and you do like this. It's in my closet in the back room, and if the power goes out, it will still work when none of these others will. And my daughter's power, they lost power for about 3 days, and she sent my grandson over to get it. And he said, "Mama, how does it work?" And I said, "You put your finger in the hole, and you go like this, and you go back and get this." I mean, you know, it's like, oh, my gosh, they don't even recognize some of these things that we had. Right. But anyway, I was
I was very mean and cruel. I was very mean and cruel to the alcoholic. He would go out drinking, and I mean, I've paced the floors, and we were going to talk when he got home. And I don't care. We were going to talk. I'd been waiting, and I had all this stuff I was going to tell him. And he would get so sick, and he'd be in there throwing up, and I'd be in there laughing at him. And I'd tell him his money was going down the commode, you know, and I'm thinking, it's my money too, you know. And I poured it out, which is a no-no. I poured it out, so he goes to buy more. He'd hang that hand off the side of the bed because that room's spinning, and I'd take it and throw it back up on the bed. You know, I just did terrible things. I was a terrible person, really, when I look back on it. But you know what? That was the best I could do right then. I was not a physical fighter. I'm not today. You just won't see me do that. If I do, y'all can just commit me somewhere. But I can't stand to see children fight. I can't see adults fight. And I've broken up children that weren't even my own. Driving down the road, and this has been in the last few years, probably in 5-10 years ago, two little boys at the school my kids are out of school. They were fighting out there, and I just stopped my car and I said, if you don't stop it, I'm going to call the police. I didn't even know those kids, but they were fighting and somebody was going to get hurt, you know. And are we enablers or what? Are we, you know, got to control things? I don't know. But anyway, I can't stand physical violence, but I could stand toe-to-toe with him in verbal violence. And I knew that he could not stand for me to call him an SOB, and that's what I did. When I got angry with him, that's what I called him. Because I knew he didn't like it, or he hated it, and that was the only way I could get at him, and so I did. And I hate that today. I hate that I did that thing. I did it in front of my children. I wish I hadn't, but I did. My kids, I'm telling you, I brought them right in the middle of this. And he was really a pretty nice, quiet, peaceful drunk. You know, I was the verbal one, you know, but it was like, if you'll just leave me alone, you know, it'll go away. But that alcoholism does not go away. And the progression of the disease does not go away. Not as long as they continue to drink, and as long as those of us who are living in it continue to act crazy and do crazy things. You know, our steps talk about restoring us to sanity. You can't be restored to something if you hadn't had it. You know, so that means I had some insanity. And some of the things I did were terribly insane. I picked our youngest daughter up one night, had cooked supper, and went across the street to the neighbor across the street's house, and Liz came in and he had been drinking. And he called me and he said, where's my supper? And I said, it's on the stove. And he said, well, if you don't come back over here and fix it, he said, I'm going to come across the street here with a baseball bat and I'm going to beat you up. I grabbed my small child up in my arms and put her in front of me and used her basically as a body shield because I knew he would not hurt her. Just crazy, just crazy. I look back, you know, and I just can't believe that I put my kids through that. But, you know, thank God for Al-Anon. They told me I did the best I could. And my oldest daughter wrote her senior theme on living with alcoholism and that she wanted to be like me. She wanted to be like me, but I was in Al-Anon then. My youngest daughter was not a person who talked about the disease in our home very much. My oldest daughter did. My youngest one didn't. And my youngest daughter has some issues today. I'm not sure really what it is. I just know she has some. But anyway, I went to work in 1970, I told you, and I don't think there's any coincidences in God's world. I ended up working in the medical record department at Crittenden Hospital. I worked there 32 years, and when I went to work there, I started to work at $2.10 an hour. We were destitute, and back then $2.10 wasn't too bad, you know, really an hour. So I tell some of the younger caretakers for my mother what I started working for, and they were saying, what? And I said, yeah, you know, that's the way it was. But anyway, I did go to work, and there was a girl who worked in that department that was a member of Al-Anon Family Groups. And you're just kind of drawn to some people like that. And we would break together and she'd say, have you ever thought about going to an Al-Anon meeting? And I said, Yeah, I said, I see the ad in the paper all the time, but I didn't know if it was still going on or if it was, you know, what. I didn't know much about it. And many of you know Ray D. I think he's been up here numerous times. And Ray was my first husband's sponsor, and I just talked to Ray this week. And he's a great guy, been a friend of our families for years. And some of those old timers, just when Judy was talking last night, she really sent me back in the past to what it was like when I came in here. But anyway, I agreed to go to the meeting with that lady that day, that night. And I remember that first meeting. I remember going there. I don't remember many of the people who were there, but I do remember going to that meeting very vividly. And Ray was going in at that time, and I knew him because he worked with my first husband. He worked at the car dealership where my first husband worked. And he had offered to take him to a meeting or whatever, and he went to a half of a meeting one time with Ray, but that was after I came into Al-Anon, and he left. But anyway, didn't come back for a few months anyway. But I went to that meeting, and I knew immediately that I was in the right place. These were people, and one of the things they told me right off was, you need to identify with your likenesses, not your differences. Don't say, oh, I hadn't done that yet. You know, let's think about our commonness that we have. That gut feeling, it's just like Lynn said about that, the heart, you know, how you connect with the heart. You just have that gut level feeling that these are people who know where you are. And I immediately got a sponsor. They told me to do that. I didn't know you couldn't do those things. Nobody ever told me that. I got a sponsor. They said, you need a sponsor. You need to come to meetings. You need to be committed to come to meetings. And I made meetings for 42 years. And I didn't know I could say no to anything. Now, today, I sponsor people. I do service sponsoring as well as just regular sponsoring, step sponsoring. And I've had people just look me straight in the face when I tell them, and they'll say no. And I'm going, what? Nobody told me I could say no. I didn't know I had a choice. And not only that, it was life or death for me. I believe if my sponsor had told me to jump off of that Memphis, Arkansas bridge, that I probably would have. I didn't know. I didn't know I couldn't say no. I didn't know that was a possibility. And even today, even like speaking, like or talking, what I do, I'm not a circuit speaker or anything like that. When someone asks me to do that, this is one of my ways of carrying the message back and giving it back a little bit of what's been given to me. And first thing I ask myself, is this a reasonable request? And if it's a reasonable request, I don't say no. I just don't. And I am so grateful that God affords me the opportunity to do things just like this. I can't tell you how important you alcoholics are in my life. I love the alcoholics. And I don't care if it's men or women. It doesn't matter to me. There's something about you, the most wonderful people in the world that I know, the most loving people in the world I know. They're always there when I need them. They've always been there, and I think they always will. And I don't care what time, day, or night it is. If I need one of them, I'll call them, and they'll come. But I got really active in Al-Anon Fellowship there, and in February of that year, of 1974, my job took me to Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is 800 or 900 miles away from West Memphis, I think. And with my boss, two physicians, and the assistant administrator of our hospital. I'd never flown in my life. I was absolutely scared to death, and I was even more paranoid when they told me there were no parachutes, you know, no, they don't work. Because, I mean, you see people jump out of airplanes, and there was none. And so somebody said, why don't you have a drink? And I said, no, I want to be able to find my way out of here if I have to, and I don't know how that's going to be. But anyway, I was there for a solid week, and during that week, my husband would call every day. And I was in meetings from like 8 to 5. And there was an Oriental guy who worked at the desk. And about the third or fourth day we were there, I came in from class that day about 5 o'clock. And he said, Miss Baskins, your husband called. I think he's drunk. I thought, great. You know, but, you know, it's not hard to tell. You know, it just wasn't hard to tell. But anyway, that very night he called back and Like I said, I'd only been in Al-Anon from November to February when I made this trip. And I guess that, like I said, I was like a sponge. And everything you told me, I was really, and I was reading my literature, and I was trying to do everything I possibly could because I was dying inside. And when he called me that night, he said, I've got a gun and I'm going to kill myself. And my mouth opened and it said, if that's what you want to do, there's nothing I can do about it. I did not have the courage to do that. God took over just like I ask him to do whenever I get behind this podium. And those words came out of my mouth. And that was Al-Anon too, you know, telling me you can't talk to a drunk. And I was 800 miles away. What could I do? Really nothing. I was totally powerless, like they tell us. My daddy at that time had gone to work for the police department. And I did ask him to call and check on him, and he did. And he was okay, and I slept, and a couple of days later, I came home. Our plane was late getting in, and I had called him to let him know that I was going to be late. And he wasn't excited about that, of course. And you remember, when you come into Al-Anon, you don't have any money, or I didn't. We were broke. But anyway, I had brought the kids a couple of little things, and I brought him a little $2 money clip. And when I walked through the door, I could tell he was drunk, and he was sitting in the living room playing Russian roulette. And I'll date myself, it was a black Naugahyde chair, y'all. Do y'all know what Naugahyde is? That's an old thing. Anyway, he was sitting there playing Russian roulette. I had left my girls with him primarily. They were there because I knew I was coming home. They were in the bedroom adjacent to the living room, the walls connected. And I handed him that money clip, and he threw it across the living room. And I just didn't say anything. And I thought, okay, you're supposed to keep your mouth shut. You cannot talk to a drunk when they're drinking. You need to do what you would have been doing if this had not had happened. So I proceeded down the hall to the bedroom, and I got dressed for bed. And I laid down. The girls were asleep. And the gun went off. And I thought, oh, no. You know, I get up. I walk down the hall, I peek around the door, and he's still sitting there, and he's alive. And so I just tiptoed back to the bed, and I said, God, if you'll let the girls and I get out of here alive tonight, we'll be gone in the morning. See, if you hadn't told me that I couldn't talk with a drunk when they're drinking, I would have tried to talk to him like I always had. And had I done that, in his stupor, I would have probably been killed, or the girls. I didn't know until the next morning when I got up to go to work. I called my mother that he had shot that gun into the wall in that bedroom where my girls were laying. It was kind of high up, but, you know, but for the grace of God again, you know, it's a God thing. And I took those girls that morning, and I left. And before I left, he was alert enough for me to tell him, when you come home from work today, the girls and I will be gone. I don't know how you feel about it, but I think once a woman leaves home and has her own place, it's very difficult to go back. But I didn't have anywhere else to go. And so I took my girls down to my mom's. I went on to work that day. And he would call me wanting me to come, and my mother would say, please don't go down there. Please don't go back down there. She was afraid he would hurt me or whatever. And I wasn't really afraid of him that way. He was not a violent person. All I knew that is, and I had told him, I cannot tell you countless times, because there were times when I went to work, I worked three jobs when he barely had one. But I had told him, I'm telling you, buddy, if anybody leaves here, it's not going to be me. I've worked and paid these bills, and if anybody leaves here, it's going to be you. But after that night, I'm telling you, it didn't matter. I left there with nothing except what I had on, and I could have cared less. I didn't need any of that stuff. It was just things. And all I could think about was getting me and those kids out of there, and that's what I did. About two or three days later, he ended up going to an AA meeting. Ray took him, and he went to a meeting. And he went in there, and he will tell you this. I went in with the intention of staying sober for 30 days and getting y'all back home, and then I was going to go on my merry way again. But thank God for you who are in the fellowship of AA that you took care of him, and he decided to stay, and he's been sober ever since. And for that, I'm eternally grateful, and so are my children and his family and all of our friends. He doesn't make meetings anymore, and that I hate that. He lives in Nashville now. I don't know. Life really turns in some mysterious ways. But, you know, it took everything that I had to get to where I am today. And he began to have affairs and all that entered into it. And thanks for the program. I realized that he has a right to be happy, whether it's with me or someone else. And like I said, we're good friends today. And I don't see him very often, but he married a girl who is 6 years older than our oldest daughter. And they love my mother. My mother loves him today, even still. And when they come to West Memphis, they visit with my mother. And I visit with them, and he and my children, and us can all go together. You know, we can eat together and all that. And I'm so grateful that this fellowship teaches you some living skills. I didn't have any of that. And when you have children, I'm telling you, you're going to be hooked together forever. I don't care whether you hate them or love them. If you have children, they're always going to be your children, no matter what they do or where they go. And you have to learn to get along in God's world that way sometimes. And I hate it when bitter things happen like that. And I know that I'm one of the chosen few who are able to do that. Not everybody can. But it's only because of these fellowships. That's the only reason. He was having affairs, and in 1982, that's close, I'm thinking 1982, we ended up getting a divorce. And I can tell you that that was the most painful thing I'd ever been through in my life. It was like I was a total failure. And someone gave me this little reading that says, failure is never final. But I walked those halls of that hospital every day with the serenity prayer, and just over and over and over I repeated it. And I'm telling you, I can totally understand how a person can take their life in a split second. I contemplated suicide in a big way. And this was 10 years in the fellowship. You know, you just lose. I loved that guy. I loved him with every being I had. He was a wonderful dad, but he just had a disease called alcoholism. And it took a terrible toll on our family. I'm really grateful today, especially for my children, that these fellowships are here, because I've got some kids that may be needing it, you know, and grandchildren. But he would take us through the clothes, and he would leave, and he would come back, and I would beg him to come back. We tried marriage encounter. We tried all the things to try to hold that marriage together. It just didn't work. And so I remember telling him, because it was tearing me absolutely apart. And like I said, I was wanting to commit suicide so bad. It was not, that's really not even an option. But it was at that time when you're so terribly depressed. And all I could think about was my children. My children. How selfish of you. You have children. And one day, God just said, I got it right here, baby. I know me. But thank you. I had Kleenex. But it was like I said the serenity prayer, and it was like God just opened the world up to me. And my eyes just came open, and he said, you are worthy. You are a whole person. You don't have to have a man in your life. You don't have to have a job. You don't have any of this. You're good. As long as you lean on me, that's all you need. That's all I need. And so today, that's the person, he's always come first since I came in this fellowship. But that day, it was so vivid to me. That's all I need. He is here for me. He's my ever, he will never, ever leave me. And I'm so grateful for that. And I'll tell you a little instance pretty soon about my mom and about how important he is in my life and what she thinks right now. But anyway, since that day, I've never, ever thought about doing anything stupid like that again. And I call it stupid, and that's for me. That's what I thought it was. It was stupid when I look back on it today. It was a terrible choice of even thinking about doing such a thing. But anyway, so I told him, I said, if you're going to take those clothes, you take them all. Because it was tearing me apart. And April Fool's Day, 1982, and it was no April Fool's joke, he came and got all his stuff. And for 3 to 6 months, I did not leave that house to go to anything except an Al-Anon meeting. And every time I went into one of those, I cried like a baby. That and open AA meetings. That's all I did. I was scared to death if I left that house, he might call and I'd miss it. And I wanted that marriage to work so bad. But I couldn't keep letting him tear my heartstrings up like that every day or every other day. I just couldn't. And it was tearing my kids up. I just couldn't do it. They were 7 and 10 when he came in the program. So, you know, by then, like I said, he was 10 years sober when all this went on. When he came in with it, went into AA. And we're talking 20 years in the program when this divorce happened. So that's why I'm telling you, there's some days when I'm the sickest one in that group. Even today, that can happen. But anyway, we divorced, and like I said, it's a very amicable thing, which is a great thing. And finally, after several months, I started going to a place over in Memphis that were for alcoholics and Al-Anons. It was actually an AA hangout called the Midtown Club, and then they had the Action Club. There were two places. And I met this guy. It was open all day, and there was a little concession stand. And I met this guy, and I did not know him, the first time I'd ever seen him. And come to find out, he was coming off his last drunk. He had come to in a lean-to shed out behind this building, Midtown Club, with straw on the floor and old cardboard boxes, and George is laughing, yeah. And coming off that last drunk, and there was a guy there that had been sponsoring him or trying to sponsor him, and he said, there's something different about him now. He said, he'd been to halfway houses and all kinds of stuff through the years. I did not know him before. And this is my first time I'd laid my eyes on him. But we started he was a musician, and we started hanging out together for a little bit. And he didn't have a place to live, and he didn't have a car, and he didn't have a job. And he was making $10 a day behind the concession stand, and it would buy Alka-Seltzer Plus and cigarettes. He was addicted to both of those. And I had a house, and I had a car, and I had a job, and he needed me. He used to laugh when he'd hear me say that, too. Oh, Lord, do you ever learn, you know? Anyway, he moved in over at my house. My oldest daughter was in college, first year. My youngest daughter was 15 years old. And it was a very amicable relationship. He had a son who came to live with us when he was 11 years old, had been in a motorcycle accident and had his leg broken, an open fracture, and the young man that was driving the motorcycle was killed, and they were using drugs. He was 11. They lived in Dyersburg, where he lived with his mom, and so Jim and I would take him back and forth. And so anyway, after 5 years, Jim and I married. And I had never seen him drink. Never saw him drink at all. But anyway, like I said, he had a musician and all that, and he had a little band, and they'd play sometime at the Action Club. And he had this old green station wagon. It was huge. It was really, really old. And he had a big amplifier that was, oh my gosh, it was as big as that thing right there.
And, you know, they're so much tinier today. But anyway, we would load that in that station wagon, and he'd go play and do stuff like that. But anyway, we were married for almost 20 years, and he had a lot of health issues and was on oxygen 24/7 and was diabetic. He had 2 MIs and heart attacks and smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day up until 1997, and I smoked, and he quit 2 weeks before I did, and I didn't even know he'd quit. Because, you know, when you smoke, you don't realize that anybody else has quit in the house. But anyway, he quit smoking. But anyway, one of the things that was so great about Jim for me was he taught me how to serve others. He taught me about how serious the morning meditation is. He would be late for work before he would miss his meditation. He spent an hour every morning in meditation. He was a tremendous spiritual leader in our home. And my first husband was not that. I carried our children to church, and he went for a little while, but not much. But he just brought that realness to the spirituality of the program, even though I'd been in the program a long time. For me, it was like it just awakened that. You know, and the steps say, after you've worked them, 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So that means the 11 before. It was like it reopened that for me. It rekindled that real strong desire I had to start serving others and putting others, you know, before me a lot of times and things of that nature. Treating people around me better. Doing for others without being found out. Just stuff like that that the program teaches you to do. And that became a big part of my life. Well, in the 19th of December, it'll be 6 years since he died. Like I said, he had lots of health issues, and we had talked about that day when that was going to come. And because of his lack of oxygen, even though he had oxygen on all the time, his mind sometimes was not really clear. And I remember the week before he died, we had taken one of the grandchildren to gymnastics, and Jim had said some off-the-wall statement to her, and she realized for the first time really how sick he really was. She was still a teenager in school, and she just sobbed. And so the next day, he made amends to her because he realized he had hurt her feelings that bad, you know. And then on that following Friday, we were sitting in the living room singing Christmas carols. The day before that, I had to sit in front of him with a cup of soup and a spoon and tried to feed him. And I would say, open your mouth, and he'd say, like a little bird. You know, his mind was just not, that was one of those days when it wasn't really clear. And I would do that. And then that Friday night, we were sitting there, and we were singing Christmas carols. Everything was great. And he had been going to a place over Memphis. We had to dance, and he'd sing a little bit with this band that was there. And we'd been doing it for a pretty good while. And we were talking about going to the New Year's Eve party, and he said, whatever you do, if something happens to me, you keep doing what you've been doing. You keep going over there and supporting those guys. And I said, okay. And he died in the night that night, about 3 o'clock in the next morning. Like I said, that's been 6 years ago, or will be in December, the 19th. And I did what one of our readings in the One Day at a Time book right here says, that I should do what I'd have been doing at that had not it happened. And so I'm going to back up just for a minute and just throw something in here. Back in 1979, my father drowned. And my girls were playing in a ball tournament, and that very statement one time, reading that over and over, stuck in my head that I need to do what I'd have been doing, and that's what my daddy would have wanted me to do. So I went to that ball game. They were in tournaments that day and took my girls. It got their mind off of it and mine off of it, and I could do anything anyway. So that has always been a thing in my mind, that when something like that happens, I need to do what I would have been doing had that not have happened. So anyway, after everything kind of settled the next week,
Jim had had this band, like I told you, and he had played senior citizen dances and stuff. That's where we played, basically. Well, we'd been going over there, and so I mustered up enough courage to go to this dance where we'd been going, and I cried when I walked in. Because when you've been going somewhere with somebody for a long time, and you have to go in there by yourself, just like when I went to meetings after that divorce, I'd go in there and I'd cry. You know, and I remember even talking about it, and one of the girls in the meeting said, after the meeting, she said, you really can't talk about that all the time. Because there are other people in here who need something too. You've got a sponsor, you use her. And I was using her, but I needed somebody full time. Anyway, but I mustered up the courage and I went to that dance, and the gentleman I have with me we've been together about 4 years. He's a musician, he has a band, and he and Jim had sang together. Jim would sing at his place, and he would come over and sing at his. And I was perfectly fine. I mean, perfectly fine as you can be after losing a loved one. I don't mean it to sound lackadaisical about it or anything like that, but I don't know how I'd have gotten through it if it hadn't been for my Al-Anon and AA friends in this fellowship. They've just always been there for me. I mean, immediately that very next morning, there were Al-Anons around my feet sitting in the floor of my living room. AA's popping in there, bringing food. It was just amazing to me how close these people in this fellowship get. They're the best family members you'll ever have. They love you unconditionally. They will always be there for you. It's amazing. It just astonishes me when I think about how powerful these fellowships are. And I know I'd be dead today if it weren't for that. My first husband was a cowboy boots and blue jean guy. My second husband was a car dealer and a musician, and he was not a blue jean person, certainly no cowboy boots. He said he wore all that stuff when he was a kid and he wasn't wearing them no more. But he said his was overalls and coveralls or whatever. But anyway, and so when Floyd, and this is my boyfriend, like I said, and I want to tell y'all, he is just an other. That's what I tell him, you're an other. He does have a brother that's been in the program, okay? But anyway, I want to tell y'all what he says about you. He said, that's the most loving group of folks I've ever been with. He loves Joanne and Milton. He just thinks they're fabulous. Y'all have always welcomed him. And he's not Al-Anon because he don't go to any meetings. I'm a firm believer, just because you're married to an alcoholic or you've got an alcoholic in your life does not make you an Al-Anon. You do get that by going to meetings and working the steps on a daily basis. So anyway, but he's always asking me things about the program, you know, and stuff like that, and wants to know how I know all these people. And I said, because I've been around a long time, you know. But he loves coming to these meetings. He loves it. And y'all treat him just like he's supposed to be here. And he is, you know. And I've never gone anywhere where I felt like I wasn't supposed to be. If it's the AAs and Al-Anons, I know. It's just like with John yesterday when I came in, he went around the door. That was so funny. And he said, do you know where you are? He was trying to tell me how to get to the motel. Do you know where you are? And I said, I know I'm right where I need to be today. I was just standing at the registration desk, but I just, you know, you just need to be right there. But anyway, I'm going to tell you a little bit about right now what's going on in my family. I have two daughters. I have four stepchildren by my second husband. They're all very close as they can be. And I have 10 grandchildren, and I have 3 great-grandchildren. My daughters, between the two of them, have 3 children. My oldest daughter is 51. She has a son that's 28. He's been in the Air Force since the day he graduated from school, or shortly after, you know, as soon as you can go in. He's been overseas 3 times to serve tours, Afghanistan, Iraq, and some other country. And last week, he and his wife, they are stationed right now about an hour from London, and they were in Paris on a pleasure trip from Wednesday through Sunday last week when the terrorist hit. And I'm so proud of him. He's my grandson that I said to him when I was much younger, Trey, he's a third. I said, Trey, when Mama gets old, you're going to take care of me. You know, and he said, oh, Mama, I will. I have to remind him of that every now and then, you know. But he and his wife got married about 3 years ago, and they're over there for 4 years. They've been there about a year and a half, going on close to 2 years now. And they are safe at home. But you talk about some scary times. He's a crew chief on an Osprey, or one of those huge helicopters that they load all that stuff on. And we got a call back shortly after he was over in one of those tours that he was over, that a helicopter had crashed. And, you know, they have to notify the parents if anything at all is going on like that. Of course, it's all over the news media before you know it. And Kim called me, and I said, I'm not going to tell Mother. You know, it was not his helicopter. But that's, you know, you don't know that until someone gives you the exact words. And I said, I'm not telling Mother till we know something for sure. And he's married to a little girl. She's a registered dietitian, and she works on the base, and they don't have any children. His little sister, on the other hand, is just turned 21 last Saturday, a week ago today. She is my mother's primary caretaker. My mother is 93 and is blind and has dementia. And just October the 15th, she turned 93 years old. And she lives with her, moved in with her this past October was a year, I think, or maybe a little more than that. In February of this year, she delivered two little identical twin girls. They weighed 2 pounds and something apiece. She has no husband. And she's taking care of my mother because she's at nighttime. And two little girls. And my oldest daughter and her husband are helping, of course. We all are. It's taken all of us to take care of my mother and them. I was going to tell you a while ago about my mother when I was talking about putting God first and all. She gets angry at me because I take a time out and go for myself once or twice a week. But I know if I don't take care of myself, I can't take care of anybody else. And she was telling one of the caretakers that she had, I have someone part-time during the day, and because I still work a full-time job. Well, I just cut back to 20 hours, but she was telling this little caretaker, she said, she don't put me first. And the caretaker asked her, well, who do you think she puts first? And she said, Floyd. And so that night when the caretaker told me, I told Mother when I came in, I said, Mom, and sometimes it's so funny because she'll wait up to me sometimes until 10:30. I'm usually, that's the latest I get in, but she'll say, she'll stay up for me like I'm a kid, you know. And I'll say, Mama, I'm so grown, it ain't even funny, you know. But anyway, I told her, I said, Mama, I said, you said that I don't put you first. And she said, she just, she'll purse those lips, you know. And I said, you're exactly right, I don't. I said, I'm going to tell you the order that my life is. I said, first of all, it's God. And I said, next is me. Because if I don't take care of me, I can't take care of you. And I said, Floyd Curtis comes down below you. And he knows that. He would tell you that your mom comes first. I know that already. He encourages me to be participating in all this stuff and the Al-Anon service work. And, you know, I've been privileged to do a lot of service work, and for that I'm grateful. Tell you about my youngest daughter. My mother has heard me talk one time. My youngest daughter has heard me talk one time. My youngest daughter heard me for the first time like 7 or 8 years ago. And she drinks more than I wish she did. She's OCD. She doesn't take her medicine like she should. Smokes pot every day, I think. Someone slipped and let me know that. I just acted like I knew. But, you know, I'm not surprised. I'm not one bit surprised that she does that. And, you know, I know I can't do anything about that. She's 47 years old. I don't have, you know, my grandmother used to say, if you can sleep with them, I can eat with them. That when I went, you know, when my mother outlived three husbands. My mother outlived three husbands. And I remember, I'd say, well, Mama, what do you think about Mom getting married? And she'd say, if she can sleep with him, I can eat with him. And I'm thinking, okay. So I think that's really good philosophy. That says it's none of my business. And, you know, I was always tickled to death when my mother remarried. And she talks about me going and dancing and all this now. And when she was my age, she was doing the same thing. So what's the difference? Whatever. But anyway, but that's my youngest daughter. I know I can't do anything about her. My oldest daughter has the two children, the son in the Air Force and the one who's my mother's caretaker. My youngest daughter I just spoke of you about has a daughter who will be 22 in January. She currently lives with me. She has looked at her mother and said, you need to grow up. Now, that's kind of reverse roles. But she's very responsible. She is a hairstylist. That's been her goal. She's been doing hair for years, and even before she got a license. But that's her job, and she lives with me, and she's very responsible. And she called me last night. I don't know what time it was, 10:30 maybe? You didn't call me to let me know you were there. But I asked her, I said, I don't care what you're doing. I just want to know where you are in case, you know, you need something or you need me. Because she's called me before. Her mother's been married twice and lives with a guy now. And the second one was a real bad drinker. And she's called us to come, you know, Mama, y'all need to come get me or whatever, you know, when things are not right. And since the day she was born, her parents were not real able to support her per se. And so Jim and I, my second husband and I, took care of her pretty much with her financial needs, whatever she needed. Not that we had anything great, but she knew that she could get it if we had it, you know, to help her. And that's the relationship that I have with her. We're extremely close. She's very responsible. The other four children are Jim's children, and I communicate with one of them or two of them. His oldest son is a musician, and so he plays, and I keep in touch with him. And his oldest daughter has six children, and I keep in touch with her. He has a daughter who lives in Atlanta that's married to a Palestinian, and I do not hear from her. Even her daddy did not hear from her for a long time. And then he has a young son, and he's kind of recluse, and I think he may drink too much. But that, you know. But that's my children, and I have another great-grandchild that I do not see. She lives in Jonesboro, and it's because my life is extremely busy with my mom and a job and all that. Life has been crazy. And have I got just a second, Scott, back there? Okay. I know I hope I've said something that's helped someone. There may be, you know, if nobody else got help today, I did. You know, and if just one person has gotten anything out of, I never know what I'm going to say. It's strictly a God talk. That's all it is, and I talk from the heart. I have all kinds of stuff here in this book. Like, you know, one of the things I heard was, if you're throwing dirt, you're losing ground. So, you know, and that's what we do often, as we throw dirt at people in our lives, you know. And, you know, one of the things they told me is, who was it? Judy was mentioning praying for someone for a length of time, and then you get to where you really mean it. You know, and one of the things I learned in Al-Anon was, and sometimes we tell secrets up here. You know, it's not a good thing to tell some of Al-Anon secrets. But someone told me that when I disliked someone, I needed to ask God to give him, you know. But they told me to ask God to give him what he deserves. and see what I think he deserves and what God thinks he deserves is probably two different things. But it makes me feel better. I mean, it's crazy, but anyway, yeah. Or that you might be right. You might be wrong, too. This is another God deal, and I'm going to close with this. For those of you who are Al-Anon who got up this morning and read Courage to Change, I'm going to read it to you, and then I'm going to... It's just God. It's just how he works. It says, sometimes I think that because I've been in Al-Anon for a long time, I shouldn't have any more problems. When difficulties do arise, I feel something is wrong with me or with the program. Actually, in some ways, I have more problems than ever. When I came to Al-Anon, I had only one problem. I didn't know how to fix the alcoholic. My life was completely in shambles, but I swore that I was fine. Today, I know that I can't fix anyone but myself, and I challenge myself daily to seek a richer, more meaningful life. I'm taking risks, facing fears, making changes, speaking up, making myself available to life. I'm bound to run into snags here and there. Sometimes life doesn't follow my blueprint. I get overwhelmed and want to crawl under the covers and hide. At such a time, it helps to remember that Al-Anon doesn't take away problems, but it does give me the courage and insight to turn stumbling blocks into stepping stones. In handling my difficulties, what's important isn't how much time I have in Al-Anon, but how willing I am to implement the tools of recovery. While Al-Anon doesn't grant immunity from problems, it does offer a healthy way to deal with them. Troubles are often the tools by which God fashions us for better things. I probably could have just read that and not have had to talk for an hour or 45 minutes or whatever. But when I was reading that, I was thinking about this granddaughter who lives with me now. I took her to area assemblies with me. I took her to Al-Anon meetings with me. She was an only child, and so she talked adult. And I have a bookmark in here. It's one of those little serenity prayer cards. And on the back of it, she said, "I love you, Bailey." You know, and every once in a while, she'll leave me a note on the fridge or something like that to tell me how much she loves me. And I truly believe that Al-Anon played a part by being around them so much that she does know something about this program. And she may need it, you know, one of these days for her mom. Or my youngest daughter, when she got pregnant, came to me, my granddaughter, and said, "Mama, he's got a drinking problem, and I know I can't do anything about it." Thank y'all for being here for my kids that may need it, and those doors stay open. I am so grateful for y'all. And thank you so much, the committee and whoever was responsible for my being here today, for allowing me this privilege to do this. Thank you so much.